Chapter 7. Storm Warning. An Old Wound. Target. Yosef Sabrat was out of his depth. The audience chamber was big enough that it would have swallowed the footprint of his home three times over, and decorated with such riches that they likely equaled the price of every other house in the same district put together. It was a gallery of ornaments and treasures from all across the southern reaches of the Ultima Segmentum. Discrete holographs labelled sculptures from Delta Tau and Pavonis, tapestries and threadwork from Ultramar, art from the colonies of the Eastern Fringes, triptychs of stunning Picts in silver frames, glass and gold and steel and bronze. The contents of this one chamber alone shamed even the most resplendent of museums on Iesta Veracrux. Thinking of his homeworld, Yosef reflexively looked up at the oval window above his head. The planet drifted there in stately silence, the dayside turning as dawn passed over the green-blue ribbons of ocean near the equator. But for all its beauty, he couldn't shake the sense of it hanging over him like some monumental burden, ready to fall and crush him the moment his focus slipped. He looked away, finding Daig by his side. The other Reeve glanced at him, and the expression on his cohort's face was muted.
"What are we doing up here?" Daig asked quietly. "Look at this place. The light fittings alone are probably worth a governor's ransom. I have never felt so common in my entire life." "I know what you mean," Yosef replied. "Just stay quiet and nod in the right places. Try not to show myself up, you mean? Something like that."
A few meters away, Hissos was mumbling quietly to the air. Yosef guessed that the operative had to have some sort of communicator implant that allowed him to sub-vocalize and send vox messages as easily as the Jaegers of the Centene used a wireless. It had been clear to him the moment the consortium shuttlecraft had landed in the precinct courtyard, the elegant swan-like ship making a point-perfect touchdown that barely disturbed the trees. Eurotas's riches clearly bought the Baron and his clan the best of everything. Still, that didn't seem to sit squarely with the neglect he'd seen at the trader's compound a day ago. He thought on that for a moment, making a mental note to consider it further. The shuttle had swiftly brought them into deep orbit, there to meet the great elliptical hulk of the Uber, flagship of the Eurotas Consortium and spaceborne palace of the rogue trader who led it. A handful of other smaller ships attended the Yubar like handmaidens around a queen, and Yosef only thought of them as smaller because the flagship was so huge. The support craft were easily a match for the tonnage of the largest of the system cruisers belonging to the Iestan PDF. The Psyker, Perig, remained on the surface, having insisted on being taken to the Blasco Lodge to take a sensing. Hissos explained that the woman had the ability to divine the recent past of objects by the laying on of hands, and it was hoped that she would find Erno Sig's telepathic spore at the location. Skelter drew the job of being her escort, and the silent panic on the Jaeger's face had been clear as daylight. The Reeve marvelled how Hissos seemed completely unconcerned by Perig's preternatural powers. He spoke of her as Yosef or Daig would discuss the skills of the documentary officers at a crime scene, as no more than a fellow investigator with unique talents all their own. In the hours after his arrival and his blunt dismissal of Lemna, Hissos had thrown himself fully into the serial murder case, absorbing every piece of information he could get his hands on. Yosef knew that the man had already been briefed as fully as the Eurotas Consortium could. How else could he have known the names of everyone in the precinct without prior instruction from Gorosp and her offices? But he was still forming his view of the situation. Daig took a few hours to sleep in the shift room, but Yosef was caught up by Hissos's quiet intensity and sat with him, repeating his thoughts and impressions to him. The operative's questions were all insightful and without artifice. He made the Reeve think again on points of evidence and supposition, and Yosef found himself warming to the man. He liked Hissos's lack of pretense, his direct manner, and he liked the man for the way he had seen right through Bert's lameness at first glance.
"There's more to this," Hissos had said over a steaming cup of recaf. "Sig murdering and playing artist with the corpses, that doesn't add up."
Yosef had agreed. But then the message had come down from command. The Void Baron had arrived, and the governor was in a fit. Normally, a visitation from someone of Baron Eurotas's rank would be a day of great import, a trade festival for Aiesta's merchants and moneyed classes, a diversion for her workers and commoners. But there had been no time to prepare. Even as the shuttle had taken them up to meet Hissos's summons, the government was in turmoil, trying to throw together some hasty pomp and ceremony in order to make it seem like this had been planned all along. Lamna tried one last time to get a foot on the shuttle. He said that Telemach had ordered him to give the Baron the briefing, that he could not in good conscience remain behind and let a lesser officer take the responsibility. He'd looked at Yosef when he said those words. Yosef imagined that Telemach was probably unaware of the shuttle or the summons, probably too busy fretting with the Landgrave and the Imperial Governor and the Lord Marshal to notice. But again, Hissos had firmly blocked the Reeve Warden from using this as any way to aggrandize himself, and left him behind as he took the two lowly Reeves up into orbit. It was an experience that Daig was never to forget. It was his first time off-world, and his usual manner had been replaced with something that approximated stoic dread. Hissos beckoned them towards the far end of the wide gallery, where a dais and audience chairs were arranged before a broad archway. Inside the arch was a carved frieze made of red Dolanthian jade. The artwork, easily the size of the front of Yosef's house, showed a montage of interstellar merchants about their business, travelling from world to world, trading and spreading the light of the Imperium. In the centre, a sculpture of the Emperor of Mankind towered over everything. He was leaning forward, holding out his hand with the palm down. Kneeling before him was a man in the garb of a rogue trader patriarch, who held up an open book beneath the Emperor's hand. Daig saw the artwork and gasped.
Who is that?
The first of the Eurotas, said Hissos. He was the commander of a warship that served the Emperor many centuries ago. A man of great diligence and courage. As a mark of respect for his service, the Emperor granted him the freedom of space and made him a rogue trader.
But the book, said Daig, pointing. What is he doing with the book?
Yosef looked closer and saw what Daig was talking about. The artwork clearly showed what could only be a cut upon the Emperor's downturned palm, and a drip of blood, rendered here from a single faceted ruby, falling down towards the page of the open tome.
"That is the warrant of trade," said a new voice, as footsteps approached from behind them.
Yosef turned to see a hawkish, imperious man in the same cut of robes as the figure in the frieze. A group of guardsmen and attendants walked in lockstep behind him, but the man paid them no mind.
"The letter of mark and statements granting my clan the right to roam the stars in the name of humanity. Our liege lord ratified it with a drop of his own blood upon the page."
He gestured around.
"We carry the book in safety aboard the Uber, as we have for generation after generation."
Daig glanced about him, as if for a moment thinking he might actually see the real thing. But then disappointment clouded his face, and his jaw set in a thin line.
"My lord," said Hissos with a bow that the Reeves belatedly imitated. "Gentlemen, allow me to introduce his lordship, Merikson Eurotas,
Void Baron of Narvaji, Agentia Nuntius of the Tibian Sector, and Master of the Eurotas Trade Consortium.
Enough, enough. Eurotas waved him into silence.
I will hear that 1,000 times more once I venture down to the surface. Let us dispense with formality and cut to the meat of this.
The Baron gave Yosef and Daig a hard, measuring stare before he spoke again.
I will make my wishes clear, gentlemen. The situation on Aesta Veracrux is delicate, as it is on many worlds among the Tibian stars. There is a storm coming, a war born of insurrection, and when it brushes these planets with the heat of its passage, there will be fire and death. There will be.
He blinked and paused. For a moment, a note of strange emotion crept into his words, but then he flattened it with a breath of air.
These killings, they serve only to heap tension and fear upon a populace already in the grip of a slow terror. People will lash out when they are afraid, and that is bad for stability. Bad for business.
Yosef gave a slow nod of agreement. It seemed the rogue trader understood the situation better than the Reeve's own commanders. And then he had a sudden chilling thought. Was the same thing happening on other planets? Had Eurotas seen this chain of events elsewhere in the Tibian sector?
I want this murderer found and brought to justice, Eurotas concluded. This case is important, gentlemen. Complete it, and you will let your people know that we, that the Imperium, is still in power out here. Fail, and you open the gateway to anarchy.
He began to turn away.
Hissos will make available to you any facilities you may need. Sir?
Daig took a step after the rogue trader.
My Lord Baron.
Eurotas paused. When he looked back at the other Reeve, he did so with a raised eyebrow and an arch expression.
You have a question?
Daig blurted it out.
Why do you care? About Aesta Veracrux, I mean.
The Baron's eyes flashed with a moment of annoyance, and Yosef heard Hissos take a sharp breath.
Dagonet is falling. Did you know that?
Daig nodded, and the Baron went on.
And not only Dagonet. Kelsa Secundus. Bowman. New Mitama. All dark.
Eurotas's gaze crossed Yosef's, and for a moment the nobleman appeared old and tired.
Erno Sig was one of my men. I bear a measure of responsibility for his conduct. But it is more than that. Much more.
Yosef felt the rogue trader's gaze pinning him in place.
We are alone out here, gentlemen. Alone against the storm. The Emperor protects, said Daig quietly.
Eurotas gave him an odd look.
So they tell me, he replied at length.
And then he was walking away, the audience at an end, and Yosef's thoughts clouded with more questions than answers. When the gullwing hatch of the flyer opened, the first thing that Fon Tariel experienced was the riot of smells. Heady and potent floral scents flooded into the interior of the passenger compartment, buoyed on warm air. He blinked at the daylight streaking in, and with wary footsteps he followed Kel out and into wherever this place was. Unlike the Eversaur, who had not been afraid to provide the group with the location of one of their Terran facilities, the Clade Veninum made it clear in no uncertain terms that the members of the Execution Force would not be free to come to them of their own accord. The Sires had been most emphatic. Only two members of the group were granted passage to the complex, and both were required to be unarmed and unequipped. Tariel was learning Kel's manner by and by, and he could see that the Vindicare was ill at ease without a gun on him. The Infocyte was sympathetic to the sniper. He, too, had been forced to leave his tools behind on board the Ultio, and he felt strangely naked without his cogitator gauntlet. Tariel's hand kept straying to his bare forearm, without his conscious awareness of it. The journey aboard the unmarked Fininum flyer had done nothing to give them any more clue to the whereabouts of the complex called the Orchard. The passenger compartment had no windows, no way for them to reckon the direction of their flight. Tariel had been dismayed to learn that his chronometer and mag compass implants were being suppressed, and now, as he stepped out of the craft, they both flickered back to life, giving him a moment of dizziness. He glanced around. They stood on a landing pad at the top of a wide metal ziggurat, just shy of the canopies of tall trees with thick leaves that shone like dark jade. The jungle smells were stronger out here, and the olfactory processor nodes in his extended brain case worked furiously to sift through the sensoria. Tariel guessed that they were somewhere deep in the rich rainforests of America, but it was only speculative deduction. There was no way to know for sure. A man in a pale green kimono and a domino mask emerged from a recessed staircase on the side of the ziggurat and beckoned them to follow him. Tariel was content to let Kel lead the way, and the three of them descended. The sunshine attenuated as they dropped below the line of the upper canopy, becoming shafts of smoky yellow, filled with motes of dust and the busy patterns of flying insects. A pathway of circular grey stones awaited them on the jungle floor, and they picked their way along it, the man in the kimono sure-footed and confident. Tariel was more cautious. His eyes were drawn this way and that by bright, colourful sprays of plants that grew from every square metre of ground. He saw small worker mechanicals moving among them. What seemed at first glance to be wild growth was actually some sort of carefully random garden. The robotics were ministering to the plants, harvesting others. He paused, studying one odd spindly blossom he did not recognize, emerging from the bark of a tall tree. He leaned closer.
I would not, Phanus.
The man in the kimono placed a gentle hand on his shoulder and reeled him back. Before he could ask why, the man made an odd knocking noise with his lips, and in response, the blossom grew thread-like legs and wandered away up the tree trunk.
Mimical spiders, from Beta Comea 3. They adapt well to the climate here on Terra. Their venom causes a form of hemorrhagic fever in humans.
Tariel recoiled and blinked. Looking again, he drew up data from his memory stacks, classifying the plant life. Castor, nightshade, and oleander. Cerbera odolum, digitalis, and Jerusalem cherry. Hemlock and larkspur and dozens of others, all of them brimming with their own particular strains of poisons. He kept his hands to himself from then on, not wavering at all from the pathway until it deposited them in a clearing. Although clearing was hardly the word, as the place was overgrown with vines and low greenery. In the middle of the area was an ancient house, doubtless thousands of years old. It too was swamped by the jungle's tendrils, and Tariel noted that such coverage would serve well as a blind for orbital sensors and optical scopes.
Not what I expected,
muttered Kel, as they followed the man in the kimono towards an ivy-covered doorway.
It appears to be a manse, said the infocyte. I can only estimate when it was built. The rainforest has reclaimed it.
Inside, Tariel expected the place to show the same level of disarray as the exterior, but he was mistaken. Within, the building had been sealed against the elements and wildlife, and care had been taken to return it to its original form. It was only the gloom inside, the weak and infrequent sunlight through the windows that betrayed the reality. The Vanus and the Vindicare were taken to an anteroom, where a servitor was waiting, and the helot used a bulbous sensing wand to scan them both, checking everything down to their sweat and exhalations for even the smallest trace of outside toxins. The man in the kimono explained that it was necessary in order to maintain the balance of poisons in the orchard proper. From the anteroom, they went to what had once been a lounge, Along the walls, there were numerous cages made of thin glassaic, rank upon rank of them facing outward. Tariel's skin crawled as he made out countless breeds of poisonous reptiles, ophidians and insects, each in their own pocket environment within the cases. The infocyte moved to the middle of the room, instinctively placing himself at the one point furthest from all the cage doors. A thing with a strange iridescent carapace flittered in its confinement, catching his eye, and the sheen of the chitin recalled a recent memory. The flesh of the Calidus had looked just the same when they had pulled Coin out of the vacuum over Jupiter. The shape-shifting assassin had done a peculiar thing, turning into a deformed, almost fetus-like form in order to survive in the killing nothingness of space. Coin's skin had undergone a state change from flesh to something like bone or tooth. Tariel recalled the disturbing sensation of touching it, and he recoiled once again. He looked away towards Kel.
Do you think the Calidus will live?
His kind don't perish easy, said the Vindicare dryly. They're too conceited to die in so tawdry a manner.
Tariel shook his head.
Coin is not a he. It's not male or female.
He frowned.
Not anymore, anyway.
The ship will heal it. And once our poisoner joins us, we will have our execution force assembled.
Kel trailed off. Tariel imagined he was thinking the same thing as the sniper. And what then? The question as to what target they were being gathered to terminate would soon be answered, and the Vanus was troubled by what that answer might be.
It can only be.
The thought was cut off as the man in the kimono returned with another person at his heels. Tariel determined a female's gait. She was a slender young woman of similar age to himself.
By the order of the Director Primus of Arclade and the Master of Assassins, said the man, you are granted the skills of Seclus Solm, first rank toxin artist.
The woman looked up, and she gave a hard-edged defiant look at the Vindicare. Kel's face shifted into an expression of pure shock, and he let out a gasp.
Jennica.
The Veninum drew herself up.
I accept this duty, she said with finality.
No,
Kel snarled, the shock shifting to anger.
You do not.
He glared at the man in the kimono.
She does not.
The man cocked his head.
The selection was made by Cyrus Veninum herself. There is no error, and it is not your place to make a challenge.
Tariel watched in confused fascination as the cool, acerbic mien Kel had habitually displayed crumbled into hard fury.
I am the mission commander,
he barked.
Bring me another of your secluses now.
Are my skills in question? Sniffed the woman. I defy you to find better.
I don't want her,
Kel growled, refusing to look at Solm.
That's the end of it.
I am afraid it is not, said the man calmly. As I stated, you do not have the authority to challenge the assignment made by the Cyrus. Solm is the selectee. There is no other alternative.
He pointed back towards the doorway.
You may now leave.
Without another comment, the man exited the room.
Solm!
Kel hissed the woman's surname with undisguised anger.
That is what I should call you now, is it?
It was slowly dawning on Tariel that the two assassins clearly shared some unpleasant history together. He looked inward, thinking back over what he had managed to learn about Aristide Kel since the start of their mission, looking for some clue. Had these two been comrades or lovers, he wondered. Their ages were close enough that they could have been both raised in the same scholar before the Clades drew them for individual selection and training.
I accepted the name to honor my mentor, said the woman, her voice taking on a brittle tone. I started a new life when I joined my clade. It seemed the right thing to do.
Tariel nodded to himself. Many of the orphan children selected for training by the Officio Assassinorum entered the Clades without a true identity to call their own, and often they took the names of their sponsors and teachers.
But you dishonored your family instead,
Kell grated. And then, for a brief moment, the woman's mask of defiance slipped to reveal the regret and sadness behind it. Suddenly Tariel saw the resemblance.
No, Aristide, she said softly. You did that when you chose to kill innocents in the name of revenge. But our mother and father are dead, and no amount of bloodshed will ever undo that.
She walked by Kell and passed a stunned Tariel, stepping out into the perfumed jungle.
She's your sister,
Tariel blurted it out, unable to stay silent, the data rising up from his memory stack in a rush.
Aristide and Jenica Kell, son and daughter of Viceroy Argus Kell of the Thaxted Duchy, orphaned after the murder of their parents in a local dispute.
The Vindicare advanced on him with a livid glare in his eyes, forcing Tariel back against a cage filled with scorpions.
Speak of this to the others, and I will choke the life from you, understand?
Tariel nodded sharply, his hands coming up to protect himself.
But the mission...
She'll do what I tell her to,
said Kell, the anger starting to cool.
Are you sure?
She'll follow orders. Just as I will.
He stepped back, and Tariel glimpsed a hollowness, an uncertainty in the other man's eyes that mirrored what he had seen in the Vindicare's sister. The Uber had decks filled with cogitator engines that hummed and whirred like patient cats, gangs of progitors moving back and forth between them with crystalline memory tubes and spools of optic coil. According to Hissos, the devices were used to gather financial condition data from the various worlds along the Eurotas trade routes, running prognostic models to predict what goods a given planet might require months, years, even decades into the future.
What are we to do with these things?
Asked Daig. He'd never been comfortable with the thought of machines that could do a man's job better. Hissos nodded at one of the engines.
I've been granted use of this module. Various information sources from Aesta Veracrux's watchwire are being collated and sifted by it. You can do that from up here?
Yosef felt an odd stab of concern he couldn't place. The operative nodded.
The uptake of data is very slow due to the incompatibility of the systems, but we have some level of parity. Enough to check the capital's traffic patterns, compare information on the suspect with the movements of his known associates, and so on. We have Jaegers on the ground doing that, Daig insisted. Human eyes and ears are always the best source of facts.
Hissos nodded.
I quite agree. But these machines can help us to narrow our fields of inquiry. They can do in hours what would take your office and your Jaegers weeks to accomplish.
Daig didn't respond, but Yosef could see he was unconvinced.
We'll tighten the noose, continued the operative. Sig won't slip the net a second time. Mark my words.
Yosef shot him a look, searching the comment for any accusation, and he found none. Still, he was troubled, and he had to voice it.
Assuming Sig is our killer.
He remembered the man's face in the cooper's shack, the certainty he had felt when he read Erno Sig's fear and desperation. He looked like a victim. Hissos was watching him.
Do you have something to add, Reeve Sabret?
No.
He looked away and found Daig, his cohort's expression unreadable. It wasn't just Sig he was having his doubts about. Yosef thought back to what the other man had said in the ruined lodge, and the recent changes in his manner. Daig was keeping something from him, but he could not think of a way to draw it out.
No,
he repeated.
Not now.
What the others called the staging area was really little more than a converted storage bay. An iota saw little reason why the name of it made so much difference. The Ultio was a strange vessel. She was still trying to know it, and it wasn't letting her. The ship was one thing pretending to be another, an assemblage of rare technologies and secrets that had been stitched into a single body, given a mission, thrown out into the darkness. It was like her in that way, she mused. They could almost have been kin. The mind inside the ship spoke to her when she spoke to it, answering some of her questions but not others. Eventually, Iota became bored with the circular conversations and tried to find another way to amuse herself. As a test of her stealth skills, she took to exploring the smallest of the crawl spaces aboard the Ultio, or spying on the Medicaid compartment where the Calidus was recovering inside a therapy pod. When she wasn't doing this, or meditating, Iota spent the time hunting down spiders in shadowed corners of the hull, catching and collecting them in a jar she had appropriated from the ship's mess. So far, her hopes of encouraging the arachnids to form their own rudimentary society had failed. She spotted another of the insects in the lee of a console and deftly snared it. Then, with a cruelty born of her boredom, she severed its legs one by one to see if it could still walk without them. Kell entered the chamber. He was the last to arrive. The infocyte Tariel had been working at the hololith projector, and he seemed uncharacteristically muted. The Vanis's mood had been like this ever since he and the Vindicare had returned from Terra with the last of the recruits, the woman who called herself Solm. The new arrival didn't speak much either. She seemed rather delicate for an assassin. That was something that many thought of Iota when they first laid eyes on her. But the chill of her preternatural aura was usually enough to destroy that illusion within a heartbeat. The Garantine's bulk took up a corner of the room, like an angry canine daring any one of them to crowd into his space. He was playing with a sliver of sharpened metal, the remains of a tool, she believed, dancing the makeshift blade across his thick fingers with a striking degree of dexterity. He was bored too, but annoyed with it. Then again, Iota had come to understand that every mood of the Eversaur was some shade of anger, to a greater or lesser extent. Coin sat in a wire-framed chair, the Calidus's smooth, flat features like an unfinished carving in soapstone. She watched the shade for a few moments, and Coin offered Iota a brief smile. The Calidus's skin darkened, taking on a tone close to the tawny shade of Iota's own flesh. But then the moment was broken by Kell, as he wrapped his gloved hand on the support beams of the low ceiling.
"Well, we're all here," said the Vindicare.
His gaze swept the room, dwelling briefly on all of them. All of them except Solm, she noted.
"The mission begins now."
"Where are we going?"
asked Coin, in a voice like Iota's. Kell nodded to Tariel.
"It's time to find out."
The infocyte activated a code key sequence on the projector unit, and a haze of holographic pixels shimmered into false solidity in the middle of the chamber. They formed into the shape of a tall, muscular man in nondescript robes. He had a scarred face and a queue of close-cut hair over an otherwise bare skull, and if the image was an accurate representation, then he was easily bigger than the Garantine. The hologram crackled and wavered, and Iota recognized the telltale patterns of high-level encoding threading through it. This was a real-time transmission, which meant it could only be coming from another ship in orbit, or from Terra itself. Kell nodded to the man.
"Captain General Valdor, we are ready to be briefed at the Master's discretion."
Valdor returned the gesture.
"The Master of Assassins has charged me with that task. Given the unique nature of this operation, it seems only right that there be oversight from an outside party."
The custodian surveyed all of them with a measuring stare. At his end of the communication, Iota imagined he was standing among a hololithic representation of the room and everyone in it.
"You want us to kill him, don't you?"
the Garantine said without preamble, burying his makeshift knife in the bulkhead beside his head.
Let's not be precious about it. We all know, even if we haven't had the will to say it aloud.
Your insight does you credit, Eversor, said Valdor,
his tone making it clear his compliment was anything but that.
Your target is the former Warmaster of the Adeptus Astartes, Primarch of the Lunar Wolves, the arch-traitor, Horus Lupercal.
They are the sons of Horus now,
muttered Tariel, disbelief sharp in his words.
Throne's sake, it's true then.
The Venenum woman made a negative noise in the back of her throat.
If it pleases my Lord Custodes, I must question this.
Speak your mind, said Valdor.
Every clade has heard the rumors of the missions that have followed this directive and failed it. My clade cohort Tobelt was the last to be sent on this fool's errand, and he perished like all the others. I question if this can even be achieved. Cousin Solm has a compelling point, offered Coyne. This is not some wayward warlord of which we are speaking. This is Horus, first among the Emperor's sons. Many call him the greatest Primarch that ever lived.
You're afraid, snorted the Garantine. What a surprise. Of course I'm afraid of Horus, replied Coyne, mimicking the Eversor's gruff manner. Even an animal would be afraid of the Warmaster.
An execution force like this one has never been gathered, Kell broke in, drawing the attention of all of them. Not since the days of the First Masters and the pacts they swore in the Emperor's service on Mount Vengeance. We are the echo of that day, those words, that intention. Horus Lupercal is the only target worthy of us.
Pretty words, said Solm, but meaningless without direction.
She turned back to the image of Valdor.
I say again, how do we hope to accomplish this after so many of our Assassinorum kindred have been sacrificed against so invulnerable an objective? Horus has legions of loyal warriors surrounding him, said Tariel. Astartes, warships, forces of the Mechanicum and Cybernetica, not to mention the common soldiery who have come to his banner. How do we even get close enough to strike at him?
He will come to you.
Valdor gave a cold, thin smile.
Perhaps you wondered at the speed with which this execution force has been assembled. It has been done so as to react to new intelligence that will place the traitor directly in your sights.
How? Demanded Coyne.
It is the judgment of Lord Malkador and the Council of Terror that Horus's assassination at this juncture will throw the traitor forces into disarray and break the rebellion before it can advance onto the Segmentum Solar, said Valdor. Agents of the Imperium, operating covertly in the Tibian sector, report a strong likelihood that Horus is planning to bring his flagship, the Vengeful Spirit, to the planet Dagonet in order to show his flag. We believe that the Warmaster's forces will use Dagonet as a foothold, from which to secure the turning of every planet in the Tibian stars.
If you know this to be so, my lord, then why not simply send a reprisal fleet to Dagonet instead? Asked Solm. Send battle cruisers and legions of Astartes, not six assassins.
Perhaps even the Emperor himself, muttered Coyne. Valdor gave them both a searing glare.
The Emperor's deeds are for him alone to decide, and the fleets and the loyal legions have their own battles to fight.
Iota nodded to herself.
I understand, she said. We are to be sent because there is not certainty. The Imperium cannot afford to send war fleets into the darkness on a mere likelihood.
We are only six, said Kell. But together, we can do what 1,000 warships have failed to. One vessel can slip through the warp to Dagonet far easier than a fleet. Six assassins, the best of our clades, can bring death.
He paused.
Remember the words of the oath we all swore, regardless of our clades. There is no enemy beyond the Emperor's wrath.
You will take the Ultio to the Tabian sector, Valdor went on. You will embed on Dagonet and set up multiple lines of attack. When Horus arrives there, you will terminate his command with extreme prejudice.
My lord, Efreid bowed low and waited. The low mutter of his Primarch's voice was like the distant thunder over the Himalayan range.
Speak, Captain of the Third.
The Astartes looked up and found Rogal Dorn standing at the high balcony, staring into the setting sun. The golden light spilled over every tower and crenulation of the Imperial Palace, turning the glittering metals and white marble a striking honeyed amber. The sight was awesome, but it was marred by the huge cube-like masses of retrofitted redoubts and gunnery donjons that stood up like blunt grey fangs in an angry mouth. The palace of before, the rich, glorious construct that defied censure and defeat, was cheek by jowl with the palace of now, a brutalist fortress ranged against the most lethal of foes, a foe that had yet to show his face under Terra's skies. Efreid knew that his liege lord was troubled by the battlements and fortifications the Emperor had charged him to build over the beauty of the palace. And while the captain could see equal majesty in both palace and fortress alike, he knew that in some fashion Great Dorn believed he was diminishing this place by making it a site fit only for warfare. The Primarch of the Imperial Fists often came to this high balcony to watch the walls and, as Efreid imagined, to wait for the arrival of his turncoat brother. He cleared his throat.
Sir, I have word from our chapter serfs. The reports of preparations have been confirmed, as have those of the incidents in the Indonesic block and on Saras Station.
Go on.
You were correct to order surveillance of the custodes. Captain General Valdor was once again witnessed entering closed session at the Shrouds, with an assemblage of the Directors Primus of the Assassinorum Clades.
When was this?
Dorn did not look at him, continuing to gaze out over the palace.
This day, Efreid explained. On the conclusion of the gathering, a transmission was sent into close orbit space, likely to a vessel. The encryption was of great magnitude. My tech marines regretfully inform me it would be beyond their skills to decode.
There is no need to try, said the Primarch. And indeed, to do so would be a violation of protocols. That is a line the Imperial Fists will not cross. Not yet.
Efreid's hand strayed to his close-cropped beard. As you wish, my lord. Dorn was silent for a long moment, and Efreid began to wonder if this was a dismissal. But then his commander spoke again.
It begins with this, Captain. Do you understand? The rot beds in with actions such as these. Wars fought in the shadows instead of the light. Conflicts where there are no rules of conduct, no lines that cannot be crossed.
At last he glanced across at his officer.
No honor.
Behind him, the sun dipped below the horizon, and the shadows across the balcony grew.
What is to be done? Efreid asked.
He would obey any command his Primarch had cause to utter, without question or hesitation. But Dorn did not answer him directly.
There can only be one target worth such subterfuge, such a gathering of forces. The Officio Assassinorum mean to kill my errant brother Horus.
Efreid considered this.
Would that not serve our cause?
It might appear so to those with a narrow view, replied the Primarch. But I have seen what the assassin's bullet reeks in its wake. And I tell you this, brother Captain. We will defeat Horus. But if his death comes in a manner such as the Assassinorum intend, the consequences will be terrible and beyond our capacity to control. If Horus falls to an assassin's hand, there will be a gaping vacuum at the core of the Turncoat fleet, and we cannot predict who will fill it or what terrible revenges they will take. As long as my brother lives,
As long as he rides at the head of the traitor legions, we can predict what he will do. We can match Horus, defeat him on even ground. We know him.
Dorne let out a sigh.
I know him.
He shook his head.
The death of the War Master will not stop the war.
Efreid listened and nodded.
We could intervene. Confront Valdor and the Clade Masters.
Based on what, Captain?
Dorne shook his head again.
I have only hearsay and suspicion. If I were as reckless as Russ or the Khan, that might be enough. But we are Imperial Fists, and we observe the letter of Imperial law. There must be proof positive.
Your orders, then, sir.
Have the serfs maintain their observations.
Dorne looked up into the darkening sky.
For the moment, we watch and we wait.